Welcome to Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Sorry about that.
All good, Dan.
Put on the wrong screen for a second.
quite all right. So, it's a bye week, but we have a lot to talk about nonetheless, because Syracuse kind of sort of hung with LSU, the, you know, number 8 team in the country. I think, what are they up to this week? Number 6?
I think they're still in the 6-8 range. Let me look that up. Probably could have had that already. But they're, you know, they're a legitimate top 10 team.
Highly regarded LSU Tigers.
Yes.
Yeah, we hung with them. And while we didn't really stop Leonard Fournette in any way, shape, or form, you know what? I never really expected us to, and I'm not sure that the defensive scheme is really designed to really completely halt him. I think it was more designed to let him get his yards and try to stop what we could elsewhere. I've seen really positive feedback, and I know we talked about it after the game, but this is kind of some of the most positivity I've seen after a loss ever as an SU fan, and I don't know what you've seen a little more nationally, Dan, as far as how SU performed, or whether everything's kind of focused on how LSU performed instead.
No, it definitely does seem like a bit of a different reaction from, I'd say both the Syracuse fan base on Syracuse fan base, and it helps that we saw that it was the most watched game of the weekend. So there were probably more people paying attention to Syracuse outside of like bowl season than have in a long time. But I mean, last year there were some games like the Clemson game and the Florida State game, which were pretty ugly, where the fan base itself kind of knew the situation with SU and all the injuries and could be a little positive about how things worked out, where, you know, nationally the team was way under 500 and no one really cared. This week, obviously, the team was 3-0 entering the game, as LSU was 2-0. LSU was the big story, but everyone was watching the game. They got to see a pretty strong Terrier Dome crowd. And Syracuse, it honestly is the first time in a while against a team like this where the only player on LSU who really seemed to overmatch Syracuse in a big way was Leonard Fournette. Which is to be expected, because he does that. He's done that to everyone so far this year, and I don't expect that to change very much. Obviously, there were some mismatches we saw, you know, on the outside, which LSU wasn't able to take advantage of us all that much. But when they did, they found, you know, big gains and a couple of really good plays with Malachi Dupree. But overall, I mean, it just looked like Syracuse was far more competitive in this game. Even with all the injuries to Irv Phillips and Rob Trudeau was moved over a position, and obviously Eric Dungy was out and no Terrell Hunt. And it was very encouraging. So I thought it was a very strong performance, and I think that's bearing out in terms of what we've seen about the team on a national level. Everyone seems a bit friendlier when it comes to the outlook on Syracuse this week than they had been when we were just beating Central Michigan by one, or beating Wake Forest by however much, does that doesn't really count.
Right. And you know what? It was an interesting, I know Sean wrote kind of, not a mea culpa post by any means, but more of a just quick, hey, there can be good here, despite what we've said, in a game against a really highly rated opponent, when you keep it close, you know, as far as scheduling goes. And it's interesting to me how the conversation shifted. I mean, even some folks that I found have been critical of us a fair amount in the past came around, at least in part, you know, just to acknowledge the fact that we really did hang in there. I know some folks who really haven't paid us much mind. I mean, even guys like Kirk Herbstreit were willing to give some praise over to SU for how they hung in there. And I think, you know, this is kind of step one. I think getting to 4-0 would also accomplish a little bit of this step one. But hanging with an opponent of LSU's caliber, I think also, you know, is building block number one in a lot of building blocks toward getting this program back to where it needs to be. I know even during Marone's years, there was always just that final hurdle, and that was never really going to be clear just because we were in the Big East. I know the one year, in 2012, we started slow, had to dig ourselves out of a hole to get to bowl eligibility. Second time around, we started fast, but against bad teams, and we're in the Big East, lost to quality teams. And that's why we never really kind of... And it was also our first year of bowl eligibility in a while, which is why we kind of mired there. The only other time we've really had this sort of conversation going around SU in the last probably... you know, 7-8 years is after the West Virginia win, when, you know, we were on national TV up against Rutgers on the on ESPN2, and they were playing Cincinnati, I believe, and, you know, SU obviously blew the doors off a ranked West Virginia team, was subtly looking like an Orange Bowl favorite out of the Big East, and then obviously the wheels came off. So it's, let's hold our horses on the 9-3 seasons, but let's at least see this as a good conversation starter for what's hopefully a very successful and promising season.
Yeah, and we were talking about it a little bit before. I think we were all happy that we kind of cross over from where you can take like a moral victory in terms of, oh, the team didn't get totally run off the field, into a place where we legitimately could have won that game if a couple things just went a different way. And it was nice to hear Schaefer, you know, he didn't put on like the, you know, everything must be positive at all times show like he did after Central Michigan. He was very clearly upset they didn't win the game, and I think that's the way it should be. I think if you're going to be a big time football program and play teams like LSU, which I know we both have thoughts about in general, you want to be in a position where you are upset about losing the game because it was very winnable. Which is not really somewhere we've been in a while. So even losing this game the way it happened, I think the way it played out, I don't think we would have even known it going into the game, but it did make me feel better because it very easily could have been a game that we were just like, you know, whatever. We got through that one, let's go on to the next one. But it was close enough where it actually felt just that tinge of disappointment where, you know, if it was a little bit more lopsided, it might have veered more into like pure moral victory territory that no one got hurt and everything else. But Syracuse, it definitely seems like we are probably closer to kind of getting to where we want to be than we even thought entering this game. And hopefully with some guys coming back, Eric Dungy, obviously, and Irv Phillips specifically, we can really see where this team is. I mean, if they go down to South Florida and have a really nice performance, they're sitting in really good positions. So, and this bye week came at a really nice time. So excited to see what the team finally looks like, because it's been kind of a weird 4 weeks, and we don't really know what this like this full offense looks like firing at you know, on all cylinders. So I hope that the South Florida game we can kind of see in terms of like number of plays run and breakdown of pass and run, and not have to worry about playing Udali Zach Mahoney, and really get start to know what the profile of this team is, because it's done a pretty good job of doing good things without actually, you know, I mean, we were obviously designed to have Terrell Hunt in there, but we've done a nice job of winning games and everything without actually showing our full hand, I think, so far.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, I've said countless times on the site, especially during the play calling breakdown articles, that I'm not sure exactly what this offense is. I know you and I have talked about it, but I'm starting to think that's a good thing. The first quarter, I was a little put off by play calling, but at the same time, if Mahoney hadn't delivered some of those balls into the ground and had gotten to receivers on short routes, maybe we would have turned it over, but it also would have established the pass a little bit more. In general, I think what I love about Lester's offense is that, you know, you don't know what you're going to get from down to down. And I think that was my biggest critique over McDonald, where, you know, and I talked to you and I talked to a lot of other people about it after the play calling breakdown article went up, which was you look and you could even see patterns from week to week, the same plays being called in the same spot in the same, you know, general direction. There was very little variance, reliance on the same guys. and obviously those bubble screens. Now we're seeing really, I mean, the fact that they were able to incorporate a Wildcat look, I mean, yeah, maybe they should have used Kentarius Womack and put a little more variance in there, because then you could have had a run or pass option. But nonetheless, having Fredericks run Wildcat, a look we hadn't seen, was a great one. Them sticking to a safe version of the option, despite minimal gains, to really keep them honest against the run, another great call. Like, I had my doubts about Lester after last year's fiasco at the end, because I felt that we were really kind of running an uninspired offense, and it was sort of mailed in many ways. But what we've seen so far, I don't think he's completely out in the safe zone, and like you're 100% approved. But Lester's definitely in that 75 to 80%. I'm pretty confident in what he's going to do week to week, win or lose. It's going to put us in a pretty good position to win a game.
Yeah, I think just the most obvious thing is, despite having multiple quarterback changes, we've already had four guys line up behind center already this year. Five, I guess, if you count Jordan Fredericks. The pace of the offense and the flow, it's night and day from last season. Last year, the offense never seemed to be confident in what it was doing, just the body language and the way they went through the motions. It always seemed confused and rushed and just unsure of itself. And now the offense looks like it's been something that these players have been running for years, and it's only been really months. So I think that's just, it's not a super tangible thing that you can look at the stats and say, but if you just watch the film this year versus, and you pull up some film from last year, I think it'd be a pretty significant difference just from what I remember. Probably fortunately don't really find the need to go look at film from last season, but I trust my memory on this one. And then, like you said, I have no confidence that George McDonald would have found a way to, and not to pile on him, he's long gone at this point, but with a fifth-string quarterback, found a way to put up 24 points on the board against LSU. And Lester did it, and, it wasn't pretty all the time. Mahoney was throwing bounce passes over the middle and had a really nice performance for what he is, but struggled in a lot of ways, and the team still lost by 10 and was down a touchdown multiple times in the fourth quarter. And if they hit another big play, it's a tie game. So I think Lester deserves a lot of credit. Obviously, we were both critical of the decision to promote him, and I still think that's fair as well, based on what we knew and what was going on with the program. But Schaefer stuck to his guns, and this could end up being a very nice win for him. So far, all the early reads are good. So it'll be interesting again to see what happens with South Florida here. This should be a team that we have a pretty definitive advantage over. Obviously, it's the first road game, which presents some interesting issues. I'm looking at their stats now. Their defense is definitely ahead of their offense. So if we put up, they're not LSU, but they have some pretty talented players on that side of the ball. If Syracuse puts up, a healthy 30-something points, I think they're in good shape to win this one, and that hasn't been a problem for the team so far.
No, I agree. And, again, not to pile on McDonald, but, he struggled to put up 24 points with a first-string quarterback last year, never mind the fifth-stringer. So, yeah, I think the offense is really – and this is something you and I talked about in the preview show and on the blog, was that – If this team can even get marginally better on offense and stay relatively similar on defense, they were looking at two or three more wins, and that's bowl eligibility. Well, through four games, the offense is markedly better, especially on first down, which is something we discussed last week. I discussed on the site, and I'll discuss every week until further notice. First down effectiveness, we're running, 12 plays on first down, of five or more yards every game. That is a huge, huge difference maker. And I don't have those numbers exactly from last year in front of me, but I guarantee that they were below five. And considering there were less first downs overall, considering that, there were less possessions, less plays run, having such a low, low number just showed like how quickly all those drives would burn out. You're seeing no matter who's a quarterback, Syracuse is able to, you know, kind of fire off, you know, right from the gate, a game and set up a drive for continued success. It's strange to see. I mean, you know what, even, I mean, I, again, don't have all the numbers in front of me, but I would bet that even the Maroon teams, even at the height of their effectiveness, probably weren't great on first down, from what I recall. And it's nice to see a team really, you know, not feel like they're behind the eight ball for an entire drive, but, you know, picking up a lot of first downs. I know, and again, this isn't a stat that I picked up, and I don't really know if anyone does track it, but picking up first downs on first and second down is just so huge. It really takes a lot of stress off linemen when it comes to blitzes on third, when you're probably going to pass. It takes a lot of stress just off quarterbacks, especially when you have young guys who don't feel like that pressing need to, oh, I have to convert here. And I think overall it's had more of a positive outcome for this team than I think we're ever going to really be able to quantify.
And it allows you to kind of do whatever you want on offense in terms of play calling. If you're not running into third and eights all the time where you're more than likely going to pass and you're constantly picking up first downs early in the set, I mean, it keeps you very varied, and you can kind of run anything in your arsenal, and it makes it a lot harder for the defense to key in on things.
I completely agree. I guess we might as well talk a little bit about the run D from last Saturday. Now, while they didn't stop Fournette much, and admittedly, maybe some over-pursuit kind of freed up some holes against Fournette. It seemed like they did a pretty fantastic job stopping anyone else from running the ball, which I thought was encouraging and was a sign that, you know, no, they might not be one of the top five running defenses in the country. They're probably still in the top 30.
Honestly, I really didn't have a huge problem with how they played Fournette. He broke a couple really big ones. He's going to break big ones every week. You know, compared to like the Auburn game where he didn't get a touch in the fourth quarter because they were up by so much, they needed Fournette out there. Aside from the series where he came out because he got hit in the groin, he was playing the whole game. And aside from a couple big plays, I think SU did a really nice job kind of limiting the chunk yardage he picked up. He didn't have a lot in between. Like, there weren't very many 15-yard runs or 20-yard runs. It was the couple big ones, and then, you know, you obviously don't want the opposing running back to pick up like 7 yards on a regular carry, but overall, I think they limited him about as well. I mean, it's early because they've only played 3 games, but I assume outside of like Alabama and Ole Miss, there won't be many other teams that do even as well as SU did. Maybe they won't have like the 70-yard or 80-yard run or the ridiculous flip that Brandon Harris pulled off, which was probably his best play of the game, but I don't know how many other teams are going to get him in the backfield as many times as Syracuse did. So if you just take away, I mean, taking away the big plays is not fair, but if you do, I think the SU defense did a pretty valiant job against him, considering, you know, what a monster he is. I mean, when Donnie Simmons made that play in the backfield, I was shocked. Like, I didn't think anyone was going to stop him in his tracks like that, but he did. And Torty had a nice game, took him down a couple times. Obviously, the quarterbacks were overmatched, but I think that's going to be life for everyone in the SEC going forward. So, and the next couple weeks, LSU has a really easy schedule. So, I think our performance in Fournette will look a little better once LSU is going up against like Eastern Michigan, and they have a couple other really pretty favorable teams. South Carolina, who's not very good, and Florida's defense is decent, and Western Kentucky. So, I don't think we're going to be alone in having given up a ton of yards in these crazy plays. And I think the numbers don't look quite as good as what SU actually managed to do against him.
Yeah, I would definitely agree there. You know, like I said, I think I maybe saw some over pursuit, but at the same time, I've heard plenty of opinions to the contrary that legitimize it, and like you said, you take away a couple of big plays. I mean, obviously there was that other run that was called back too that could have been an absolute disaster. But if you know, if you look at it as the goal was not to let Fournette beat you, but give Fournette a challenge while making the remainder of the team beat you, I think by and large, mission accomplished. You have some better play in the secondary, perhaps, and those couple of big balls from Anthony Harris, you know, don't make it into receivers' hands. It just seemed that there was just a few too many pass plays that allowed LSU to pull off a 10-point win. That's not to say that we were, you know, upset bid was thwarted, or like an extreme upset bid was thwarted anyway, but, you know, I'd say starting with a missed field goal at the end of the first half and then rolling into the second half for LSU to kind of go up, you know, early on in that third quarter. That was kind of where it was buried, but the distance just became a little insurmountable based on what LSU could do on the ground and what we were able to do through the air.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously it didn't help that the one time that LSU needed to make a mid-path play, they were able to do it two plays in a row and hit a touchdown. That kind of sealed it.
No one covering anyone.
No, not that I expected anyone to cover anyone. I mean, I've come to learn that, you know, when you get past, like, the 10-yard cushion, or when you get before it, really, if you're not 10 yards out, you're going to be open. There's a very fine line where Syracuse plays pass defense.
That's fair. So I guess looking a little bit at some of the advanced stats, I know we did this a little bit last week. We'll try to do it a little bit shorter while also, you know, picking the more engaging stats of all. I think for me, we kind of touched on this, explosiveness. SU's 32nd in the country in explosiveness. That's huge in my book. And finishing drives, it's something that we were just deplorable at last year. And, you know, in all of our trips to the red zone, we've only failed to score once this year. That was the missed field goal by Cole Murphy at the end of the first half. We scored a touchdown on nearly half of our trips. I think that the red zone offense has sneakily become something we don't have to worry about through the air. As far as running the ball, I'm a little more worried. But again, if we can get it in somehow, I'm much more comforted by that.
I think it just comes with having more options. Obviously, Strickland's carries, his touches haven't been, you know, he hasn't gotten a ton of opportunities yet, but he scored, what, 3 touchdowns and like 10 carries or something?
Yeah.
Or 10 touches overall, something like that. I mean, the guy knows how to get to the end zone. Frederick seems like he'll end up being a pretty good red zone option. He's a very powerful runner. Obviously, when Dungy comes back, he's, you know, the option, I think, is always a fun... I mean, it's a little risky, but it's a fun thing to use near the end zone because it, you know, forces defensive players to make the right reads. And we have guys like Custis, who's starting to delve a little more into the... We saw a little more of him last week after his touchdown against Central Michigan, and I think Ben Lewis could end up being a really nice red zone target. He's probably one of our better possession receivers. You know, Steve Ishmael's just great, obviously. It just seems like we have a very interesting array of weapons, and they're starting to feel out their roles in ways that they haven't in a couple years. And Lester is definitely calling, you know, he's definitely finding ways to get guys open. I mean, that throw to Ben Lewis for the touchdown last week, you know, great throw by Mahoney. He was definitely more comfortable throwing to the boundary. Lewis seems to almost be on like an Alec Lemon path, where he had some really bad drops last year, and now he's looks pretty sure-handed, and he's putting those past him. So I'm encouraged, and you know, even if we're getting held to field goals a couple half the time, it's such a marked improvement over last year where they just could not score. I think it's definitely encouraging.
Yeah, and you know what? You actually took the words right out of my mouth as far as Ben Lewis. I think that catch-no-catch situation against NC State had an impact on him, whether he'll admit it or not. It's great to see him so well-utilized within this offense. I know we talked about it before the season. I felt like he was a big key to this thing running well. You know, he has a deceptive amount of speed. He probably isn't like a full-time slot receiver, but he provides variance, and you know, is despite what the Ben Lewis jet sweeps and Ben Lewis backfield tosses are not doing as far as yardage pickup, what they are doing is they're making him a wild card for defenses, and it's really creating some questions for the linebackers in particular, which then opens up stuff for whoever's throwing the ball, whether it's Dungy or Mahoney in the middle of the field, as well as kind of toward the boundary. I know that's kind of where Mahoney operated, but I think we'll see things come back a little bit when Dungy returns, hopefully against USF. One more thing about the offense before we kind of start departing into halftime. Tight end. I felt that I said before the season, tight ends are a huge, huge asset to any kind of West Coast style offense. They're a huge asset to young quarterbacks. I didn't see that really from Dungy. I felt like tight ends, whether it was Kendall Moore or Josh Paris, were doing more blocking and doing well, by the way. But I felt like Mahoney, on the other hand, really kind of knew where Josh Paris was at all times, was willing to use him as a safety valve. And I really do hope that Syracuse does a lot more of that, because, if you're gonna play like Dungy and you're going to be able to find anyone on the field, then sure, great. But sometimes with those check downs, you can just find – Paris is a big target, and he's a guy that, with the ball in his hands – he can get some second chance yardage. He can be a good, option within the red zone. He just has a lot more versatility than I think he's been used with. And I hope that this is the year that that's kind of discovered by this offense. Dan.
Yeah. For some reason, I'm trying to unmute and my phone keeps on going black. So it won't let me.
It's a light.
Yeah, it's being bizarre. No, I agree. And last year, they really couldn't have used the tight end less. So even the little that we've done so far, and I just calculated it out while I was trying to get my phone to work, between Paris, Moore, and I guess we threw one pass to Cam McPherson at some point, we're targeting the tight ends just over 18% of the... We're targeting the tight end 18.3% of the time total, which is the same as we were targeting Steve Ishmael by himself. I think that could tend to go up a little more, because I do agree that Paris is probably a weapon that we want to use a little more. Obviously, Custis isn't listed as a tight end, but I think he's in that same group of just kind of big targets. You want it near the end zone. So hopefully we see a little bit more from once Dungy gets back in and he gets comfortable with him. It's still... With him, it seems like, there's been so much talk about Dungy, but between the, because he got knocked out pretty early in game three, and he didn't play nearly all of the first game. He played really like two plus quarters. We're really only a game and three quarters into Eric Dungy's career.
Yeah.
Truthfully. So it's tough to totally know what he is. I think we all think he's going to be pretty good, but it's a really small sample size to kind of see what his actual tendencies are and what his strengths are. We just see little things here and there. But really just one full game under his belt, and the Wake Forest one where he was pretty rough for the first half and quite good the second half. So hopefully he starts to, he expands the field. He'll definitely expand the field compared to Mahoney, who for whatever reason just did not complete passes inside the hashes. I heard some people say it might be a defense reading issue, which is definitely a possibility considering LSU has a really nice secondary and doesn't do too much in terms of exotic blitzing. It didn't seem like they're more trying to disguise their coverages. So we're actually kind of got lucky that he did put some of those balls in the dirt because they were not catchable by anyone. And I was actually surprised he was able to do so much on the outside in terms of, making big plays there. But yeah, the tight end, definitely something that has worked well for Syracuse in the past. If you look at how Nick Provo was used, he was pretty prolific his last couple years. And we have a possible really good tight end looking at the stool now that we might want to impress. Not that we should base our play calling on that, but It certainly wouldn't hurt to have Josh Paris have a nice 80-yard game coming up when a certain someone's making a decision.
Yeah, honestly, I would love. I mean, you know what? Moore and Paris are going to ride out their time. I mean, they're both juniors. And I'd love to see Dunkelberger and Clark lined up. I think that would be really, really tough to cover, to be honest. Like, give really two huge targets, two guys who can really catch the football. It seems like at least Dunkelberger has had a block as well. I didn't really take a look at any of the tape on Clark, but having some targets like that would be really a great asset for a guy like Dungy. Especially he's so great at throwing on the run too, that it would make sense that a tight end would kind of be there as that kind of last resort if he's running away from pressure but not running to gain yardage. And I think that that's something you'll see from him a little bit as he matures, whether it's this season or next season. I think that's going to be those quick dump offs to the open tight end because he's a huge target. That's where a guy like Dunkelberger can come in. It's where a guy like Clark perhaps could come in later on. And it's where a guy like Jamal Custis can come in this season. It's insane we've only targeted him twice, but both times in the end zone. I think Custis is going to eventually work his way much, much more into this offense than he has been so far.
Yeah, and obviously Chris Clark was who I was referring to. He's a now UCLA transfer who Syracuse was the first team to offer him out of high school. He went to Avon Old Farms up in Connecticut. He originally committed to North Carolina and then committed to Brady Hoke at Michigan. And then Brady Hoke got fired because apparently Chris Clark didn't pay attention to how that was going to happen. And then he flipped to UCLA on signing day. I've seen some people like be kind of skittish about going after him. He's a 5-star player. Those don't pop up for Syracuse all the time. And I don't think SU's in a position to not look into a player like that, no matter how it comes about. So, I mean, what's the worst case scenario? He's not going to bring down the program by himself if it doesn't work out. I mean, we had Quintafunderburg, who wasn't quite as highly touted, but he was a 4-star player coming from SEC school, and he didn't work out at all, and the program just was what it was. So, I think I'm all for bringing him in if he wants to come. It sounds like he's going to be here over the weekend, which is kind of weird because there's no game. But that would be a big win for SU, even, just if it gives us a shot of having a player like that. And if it doesn't work out, I don't think he's going to be the bane of the program if he's disgruntled or whatever. I saw a lot of people like really overly worried about stuff like that, I think.
Yeah, and you know what? I think some people might grab the Funderburg comparison. There might be some others. This is a very different case than somebody who's a 4-star who plays a couple of years at a big school and doesn't work out, and then they come to Syracuse as a rebound. This is a guy who was a 2015 5-star player, one of only like 19 guys to receive 5-stars in most of the recruiting services. And he's after one game and a couple weeks on campus, he kind of homesick, wanted to be a little bit closer to home back in Jersey. I can't really blame, I can't blame him, and I know I saw some criticism about him. How could he be homesick? Why didn't he realize this? There's plenty of adults who live right near where they grew up. There's plenty of adults who live thousands and thousands of miles from where they grew up. People can be homesick. People can, feel like they need to be closer to friends and family. That's a little bit easier to compartmentalize when you're 25 versus when you're 18. This kid is literally months removed from being a 5-star recruit. It's not like it's years later. Who knows if he comes to SU? I like our chances a little bit based on who we're up against. I think that, to be honest, this weekend's NC State-Louisville game might go a long way toward whether or not he heads toward the Wolfpack, but we'll see. I don't really know what's in his head right now, and I'm sure he might not even either at this point.
Yeah, and he had kind of an expedited decision to make once Brady Hoke was fired. And I saw, there was still a lot of criticism of him. And I get it's kind of weird that someone would like not want to play or not want to play at Michigan after Hope getting switched out for Harbaugh, but you have to think about how those two coaches are. Personality-wise, they're incredibly different. Obviously, Harbaugh is a much better coach by all accounts and based on everything we've seen, but he's not someone I imagine everyone wants to play for. So, and Mora is actually kind of similar. I mean, we saw how Mora treated Josh Rosen this summer, and obviously Rosen's handled it fine and has been really good so far as a freshman. But, you know, not every kid is going to respond to every coaching style exactly the way that is it's meant. And coaches, when they're recruiting kids, I mean, they're selling. So, you know, a coach might not be the guy that a recruit thought he was committing to. So you can't – I don't know. I don't like judging 18-year-olds on making a decision that wasn't right for him. And, you know, good for Chris for figuring that out early and moving on. You know, maybe it doesn't work out. Maybe there is something about him that it doesn't speak highly of, but I'm never going to, you know, get too worried about a kid based on him not making a correct college decision, because what is it, like a quarter, a third of regular college students do the same thing? So if we can get him, I'm all for it. And I hope he has a good time this weekend. It should help that he did have a lot of contact with SU early in his recruitment. So he's probably more familiar with SU than he is with any of those other schools on the list. But obviously, it's hard to tell how these things will shake out.
Agreed. I think that's a good way for us to segue into beer. Dan, what have you been drinking?
A lot. I was up in Syracuse over the weekend.
Yeah.
So was able to get a lot of the local favorites, or just the you know, stuff that that's is on tap at certain places. Spent most of my time around the campus area, though we did go to Blue Tusk and a couple other places. The highlights, Southern Tier Pumpkin. I might end up bringing this up every week. I don't care. Same with, and also about, you know, Ballast Point Grape from Stolpin had that too. If that's around, I'm probably going to get it. Founders All Day, something I talk about a lot, was the go-to tailgate beer. Maybe not the greatest thing in the morning, but, you know, it did the job. It was really early. Had some old Fagan standbys. Ithaca's Apricot Wheat, UFO Raspberry Hefeweizen. There was some Bell's Two Hearted, which always I haven't had in a little bit, so that was always nice. Had some Abita with the LSU folks. They were also, the LSU people were great. Like, I know we weren't really into scheduling SEC teams, but in terms of like making up for the fact that it was almost definitely going to be a loss, and it helped that it was a lot closer than we thought. But the LSU fans, like, they lived up to the billing in terms of like just general friendliness and being really fun. So if we're going to have to play a team like of that caliber, definitely would rather it be LSU based on my interactions with a lot of those people this weekend. And then some other things. I went to Chuck's, so Honey Brown happened. I don't know how I feel about it the day after, but that's the reality of the situation. And then tonight I was at dinner before the show. Was able to have some Shipyard Pumpkin Head, which is one of my other favorite pumpkins. That's not Southern Tier. And Two Roads Honey Spot Road White IPA, which I bring up a decent amount. I haven't had that in a while. And also, I didn't drink at the game itself, but I noticed around the dome, it seemed like there was a lot more. They definitely, I mean, since last time I've been there at least, or I don't know how recent a development this is, but there seemed to be a lot more local things available throughout the concourses. So I saw plenty of Middle Ages, some SPA, some stuff from Empire, some stuff from Saranac, like not just at like one or two stands, but even at some of the pop-up ones, just kind of in the middle of the concourse, which was cool to see. And saw a lot of people drinking them too. Not as much Labatt, more Middle Ages, more Empire. So very always support that.
Very nice. That gives me yet another reason to head back soon. Definitely nice one-stop shop, some SU sports, some Syracuse area beer. So yeah, for me, I was down in San Diego for part of the weekend, Thursday night through Friday night. Stayed for the Padres game and then drove back. So no beer at Petco Park, which is depressing because that place is loaded. They have an entire beer concourse. Ballast Point has a restaurant in there, as does Stone. So it's loaded with beer. I highly recommend going there for anyone in or not in the area. But some of the things I drank... Liberty Station, Stone, one of Stone's several locations in the San Diego area, they had their second anniversary Mocha IPA. It was a chocolate and coffee IPA, and phenomenal, phenomenal beer. You know, Stone can be a little adventurous sometimes with their non-IPAs, and sometimes they're hits, sometimes they're misses. This was an IPA, this was a hit, and very much so. I would recommend that beer to anyone. I really wish I had been able to get a growler of it. I forgot mine up here and was not going to buy another growler. My wife would have divorced me. Some other things I had. Stone also had a barrel-aged brown with sour cherries. I really, really like that one a lot. Stopped over at Ballast Point's tasting room and R&D kitchen over in Little Italy in San Diego. And had a couple different things. Their Captain Secret Punch was, I believe... I want to say Passion Fruit Lager. That sounds right. We're going to go with that. Also had had Stone's Encore 888 Vertical Epic Ale over at their Liberty Station location. Another really enjoyable one. Had over at Pizza Port, The Burning of Rome. It's a double IPA from them. And Modern Times, which I mention a lot around here. Fruitlands was their cherry goza, and just very, very, very good beer. Fresh, delicious. It was pretty hot down there, so it was nice to get a little relief from that. Had Monkish. They had their Saint Citra. It was a Belgian pale ale with a Citra hop focus, as you might be able to glean from the name. Had the Kern River Shuttle Bunny, their anniversary double IPA. Picked that up down in San Diego and brought it back up here. Then I had a very interesting one that I wasn't a huge fan of, but you might have liked, Dan. It was an IPA Rattler from King Harbor. It was kind of an IPA brewed with like a lemon soda zest. Really had a very light flavor. A little sweet for me, but I'm definitely more on the bitter side. But yeah, it was a good drink to have while hanging out by the pier.
I've not seen an IPA Rattler or anything like that, but definitely interesting. I think it has to be pretty citrusy to begin with to really work, though. I imagine that's what it was.
Yeah. All right, so the second half of this show, at this point, the back quarter of this show, we'll talk about baseball. So for those who aren't baseball fans, sorry, Sean. This might get painful. Dan, I know you are clutching pearls over there with the with the Cespedes news.
Yeah, apparently it came back negative, so it sounds like just a bruise, but I watched it and like immediately cringed. The Mets game is on now as we were recording. They actually just went down to the Phillies are up 6-5. It's not like a super meaningful game, but the Mets and Dodgers are both kind of playing for home field in that series. But Cespedes got drilled in the wrist by a fastball a couple innings back. It definitely looked like something that could have been like a broken bone. He went down pretty hard. It sounds like it's not, but you know, obviously you never want to see your power hitter get nailed in the wrist by a team that's like a million games out. Like a week or two before the playoffs, but hopefully it's all negative, like is being reported.
Agreed. That was the first thought that I had when I saw that come up on Twitter. And that goes for one team that I have an affinity for, but some might call me a traitor. I would not disagree with them. Dan and I were joking about it last night on Twitter after the Los Angeles Dodgers, a team which I hold season tickets for, clinched the NL West, their third straight such title. Two of the last three times that they've done so, the San Francisco Giants have proceeded to win the World Series, which irks me to no end. Luckily, they won't be making the playoffs this time around. That's a relief. But Dan, how do you view the Dodgers, or in particular, how do you view Clayton Kershaw, who is just a terrifying individual, professionally, personally? It just seems that, I know that I think, you know, Mattingly was just completely and utterly terrified to even suggest taking him out of last night's, one hit shutout.
I'm going to hope that all the people who are really dumb and think that there's something with Kershaw being like a bad postseason pitcher is not just like a small sample size thing. I'm going to hope that they're totally correct and he just bombs out when the calendar flips to October. For some reason, that doesn't make any sense. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to work out. I think Kershaw's really good. I think Greinke's really good and maybe better this year. I'm not as worried about the Dodgers bats as I would be the Cubs or the Pirates, who killed us this season. But when you're facing two guys like Kershaw and Greinke, it's really tough to bet against them in a short series, especially. I mean, the Mets have great arms, but Harvey and DeGrom, you know, they've been really good this season overall, but they've been a little shaky down the stretch, I'd say. They're throwing more innings than they're used to. They're both really young, whereas Greinke and Kershaw are pretty, you know, they're legitimate veterans. So yeah, I mean, you're never going to face an easy team in the baseball playoffs. It's one of the nice things about even with the expanded like extra team each league, I think it's the most exclusive playoff in American sports, which is nice. And for us Mets fans, I mean, there's a little bit of like us just being happy to be here because we're at least a year ahead of where we anticipated heading into the season. Most didn't think this was a playoff team, and it wasn't a playoff team until Sandy Alderson made some moves to pick up guys like Cespedes and Juan Uribe and Tyler Clippard. But at this point, I mean, it seems like it's tough. Both teams are good enough to, I think, run through this whole side of the playoffs and go to the World Series. I think the Dodgers are probably the safer bet in terms of, you know, being a little more experienced. The Mets, I could see them just totally going in the tank, and I could see them going on a ridiculous tear, which they seem to do like in 2 week spurts at the end at this point. Unfortunately, you know, we don't know what Cespedes' status is. I assume he'll be okay for the playoffs, but he's been a little cold, whereas guys like Lucas Duder heating up. It all really comes back to the pitching. If we can get Harvey and DeGrom to come close to matching what Greinke and Kershaw do in the first couple games, assuming those are the matchups, I think the Mets have a decent shot. I think their bats are as good or better than the Dodgers, but it's scary. I don't want to really – I would love to not have to go against those two to lead off a series, but here we are. So I guess I'd rather face the Dodgers than the Central teams, but it's not going to be a cakewalk by any means for either side.
Oh, agreed. You know, you said this before. This is a nightmare scenario for me, someone that may or may not hold dual fanships. This is why, if you're going to hold dual fanships, never do so in the same conference or, in this case, league. It's really stupid because your teams can face one another before you even get to the championship round. I will say, looking at it now, the Dodgers have obviously gone on their own hot streaks and struggled, and struggling especially in this last few weeks. You know, they got swept by the Rockies, lost the first game to the Giants of this series before pulling off a really big 8-0 victory last night. I think that the key to this series, more than, you know, previous Dodgers teams under this management, is the fact that this rotation is too deep. It's just Kershaw and Greinke, and if you can beat one of them, you stand a pretty good shot at winning a series. And that's the thing where the Mets have a pretty distinct advantage. I mean, assuming one of Harvey or DeGrom can beat one of Greinke or Kershaw, now you're looking at Syndergaard going up against probably a god-awful Alex Wood, you know, maybe a Brett Anderson or a Mike Bolzinger. I'm assuming one of those three gets cut, probably Alex Wood, to be honest. You're probably looking at a Brett Anderson, who's been serviceable, and he's actually stayed healthy all season, but he's an older guy. He's just not he's not your typical third starter, and if it was up to the Dodgers, he wouldn't have been the third starter. Obviously, alluding to season-ending injuries for, you know, Hyunjin Ryu and Brandon McCarthy, which obviously would have set them up as the third and fourth starters. This staff was not supposed to be too deep. It was supposed to be a little bit more well-rounded. So, yeah, I think if the Mets can steal one, and Dan, that'll lead to my next question. Do you think that the Mets are better off playing this one with home field advantage, or do you think it's a wash?
I think we want home field. Earlier in the season, it wouldn't have even been a question. The Mets were destroying teams at Citi and playing like 400 ball away from Citi, and that's the road split has really moved back, kind of regressed to the mean, and the Mets are playing pretty good baseball on the road now too. But I still think this team, I mean, the two ballparks are they're both pitcher's parks, so it's not like, you know, one's a bandbox that the Mets would have to worry about. But I think you definitely want home field where available, especially for a guy like Syndergaard, who I could almost see them pitching him in the first two games at Citi if the Mets hold on to get home field. He's been a little better on the road as of late, but for most of the season, his splits were pretty crazy. He was dynamite at Citi, and then he would get shelled on the road. So I still like to have that advantage, especially with the pitchers being so young. I like having them in environments where they're pretty comfortable.
Fair enough. And yeah, I think it's always the better bet to go with that over, obviously, especially in this case, you're looking at a 3,000-mile trek for both teams, and the fewer times you have to do that, especially when potential Game 5 would feature likely, you know, Greinke or Kershaw, you know, the guys who at this point will have won, you know, four of the last five Cy Young Awards. Not the best folks to go up against, but yeah, I guess, how do you feel, and, you know, this is me being several years removed now from being as down in the weeds in the day-to-day for the Mets, do you still feel like the other shoe is going to drop? I mean, I know personally, as someone watching a little bit from afar, both literally and figuratively, it never really felt like things were completely wrapped up until they were. Are you just waiting for the inevitable collapse, or are you allowing yourself to be optimistic?
I'm trying to allow myself to be optimistic, but it's very difficult with this team. Even just tonight, the Cespedes thing, like, when that happened, I was pretty sure he had broken his hand, and it doesn't sound like that's the case, but, you know, but the Mets, you don't even have to, like, be a pessimist to expect everything to go as poorly as possible. And down the stretch this year, I never felt totally comfortable until, once the magic number got to one, I felt pretty good about things, considering there was like a full week of games left. But it's hard. I mean, the last, since 2006, or, I mean, really even including 2006, with the way that Cardinals series worked out, it's been tough. I mean, I haven't seen a championship. The closest we've gotten was getting destroyed by the Yankees in a World Series, which is brutal, being a Met fan. And then the last, since 06, just what happened in 07, 08, and then just this long grind back, it's, you know, it's been the happy moments have been very few and far between, and we've been grasping on to, like, singular players and singular performances rather than actual full team. And this one is really a special group, and probably my favorite Met team to date, honestly. But it is hard to just not wait for some crazy awful thing to happen, even if we're like way at exceeding expectations for the season already. I mean, if you had told me in April, you know, the Mets were going to win 90-ish games and win the NL East and go to the playoffs, I probably would have signed for that no matter what happened after that. But now, you know, we look like a real contender, and I think they have a very good shot of beating the Dodgers, but, you know, I could see something terrible happening and Harvey and DeGrom both getting bombed in the first starts and then it being all over immediately. So hopefully that doesn't happen, but with the Mets, like, you could tell me literally anything and I'll be like, yeah, that's possible. That could happen.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I would definitely agree with you. I think the Mets are always... this really does go for any team, especially with the way that the MLB playoffs are formatted. I mean, anyone can beat anyone in a five-game series. You could have a five-game series between the worst team in the league and the best, and I'd say that there's at least a 10% shot that the worst team can get out of that series in that five-game format. I think this is going to be an interesting series regardless of where it is or who's healthy and who isn't. I think it really just depends on which team is gonna right themselves first. I know both teams have been streaky all season. The Mets, in particular, have gone on some really nice runs. The Dodgers gave themselves a really nice run to put some separation between them and the Giants going into this week's series. So I think really whichever team gets out of their current like 500 ball funk first, that they're obviously going to be the ones to get out of that round. I mean, baseball, unlike the NFL, and unlike probably college basketball, a team that goes on a run at the end of the regular season doesn't really mean anything going into the postseason. It's much more similar to hockey and basketball in that regard, where anything can happen. The season basically hits reset. And you can never say with any certainty that a team, at least in the last 10 years to 15 years, is just going to win. I mean, the last team that I was fully and 100% confident they're going to win the World Series was probably the 98 Yankees. Or the last team that I watched, I sat there and went, yep, like World Series title, there's no doubt about it. I think with those days over, I know some people are willing to put all that money on the Cardinals this year. I think let's hold off. Let's understand that the wild card game provides a huge, huge boost for teams from a morale standpoint, from a momentum standpoint. I think it's almost become a bit of a punishment for the top team in each respective league to have to face that wild card winner. But yeah, anything can happen. It's going to be a fun month.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that I hope the Cardinals get swept immediately.
I think everyone in the country is a is a fan of whoever is facing the Cardinals.
Yeah, the Cardinals are the worst.
They're the worst. The Giants are also the worst, though they're not in the playoffs this year. The Yankees are the worst, but they hopefully won't last very long in the playoffs this year. I am hopeful that the nightmare Cardinals-Yankees setup does not happen. I have only had to witness two real nightmare championships in pro sports in my lifetime. I'm, of course, referring to the Eagles-Pats Super Bowl and then the Yankees-Phillies World Series. These were things that I did not enjoy in any way, shape, or form, and I would never like to see again.
Yeah, I mean, luckily the Phillies are kind of circling the drain, but the Yankees-Phillies World Series was brutal.
I was rooting for the Yankees. It was painful.
I don't even remember. I don't know if I was rooting for... I think I was just rooting for mayhem. Like legitimate... I was hoping, like, the Huns would invade or something. Like, it was... I couldn't deal with that series. And Yankees-Cardinals would honestly, like... That would, I think that would actually be worse. The Cardinals fans are the absolute horrendous. Worst people. They're so annoying.
It would be such an argument of traditionalism and grititude and playing the game the right way and just things that no one deserves.
They're like if you like took everything that's annoying about Notre Dame football fans and like condensed it into like a steroid and injected it into baseball fans.
Ugh. honestly, like, I know, like, and this isn't a criticism of the people I work with in St. Louis necessarily, but I work with a lot of people in St. Louis because that is where my company is based. And the things about the Cardinals, Jesus Christ, it just never ends. Especially
so classy.
Yeah, the classiness, and I mean, you know as well as I, you know, that the Cardinals are not, you know, graceful in their victories in the playoffs between 06 with the Mets, which is a series that haunts my dreams forever, or you know, the last two Dodgers series too, with so much talk of class and all this like BS, and you know, you watch those games and it was a lot of Cardinals running their mouths, and it's similar to a lot of the Yankee crap that we saw at the end of the 90s into the early 2000s. It's just trying to create an aura. You know, the Cardinals fans seem to forget a pretty dark stretch for that franchise from the late 80s through the early 2000s when they finally got back on their feet. I mean, even the McGuire years were largely spent in the cellar of the NL Central. And it is kind of funny to me how quick the memory just fades away.
Yep, a decade of pretty solid success will do that. I don't know if the Mets would ever be that. I think the Mets build in like just disappointment and self pity so quickly into their fans that I think the Mets would win like five straight World Series and you'd still be waiting for the team to implode. So we just own it. That's our identity as a fan base. We're the Cardinals. You know, we have people arguing that Yadier Molina is a better player than Mike Trout. So, baseball playoffs. At least I'm happy to be involved, but man, I'm not looking forward to. I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing maybe that the Cardinals, because they haven't looked great down the stretch, just get like run by the Pirates or the Cubs. I'll be very much rooting for those, whichever one comes out of that that likely wild card game.
Agreed. And yeah, I guess we'll end our bi-week / baseball podcast there. Dan, thanks as always for joining us.
Yes, go Mets, go Syracuse, go everyone else.
Go Syracuse.
Not Cardinals.
Go not Cardinals. I'll say go Mets and Dodgers. That way I can continue to sit on the fence. And I
just hedging so hard.
I mean, I'm not even hedging. I'm being completely and utterly honest about the fact that I'm a traitor. I get it. But since I hate the Cardinals so much, and I also kind of dislike the Cubs, I'm going to be rooting for whoever wins this series in the NLCS anyway. So I'm not, like, I'll be completely real. I will not be buying a t-shirt, regardless of if one of those teams win the World Series. You will not see me with a t-shirt. I will not celebrate the victory as my own because, let's be real, either way, it isn't. And that is the moral of the story. When you want to split your fanhood, you end up feeling like you are a part of neither.
You're a man with no country.
Correct. Luckily, I have a very orange country to go back to whenever I feel like it. And that's Syracuse, obviously. All right.
Well...
Perfect place to end it. Dan, check your smoke alarm.
Yeah, I know. It's been going off the whole time. I come home for one day, and apparently my smoke alarm is just going... I haven't been able to do anything about it. I've been here all day.
Fair enough.
It's awful.
All right. Go Orange.
Go Orange.